Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we're going to hear about the struggle against voter exclusion in U.S. elections with Mark Favreau, author of Represent, the Unfinished Fight for the Vote. But first, a new report out today from the Brenham Center for Justice at NYU. Law shows how gerrymandering gives Republicans an advantage when it comes to winning seats in Congress. The study is called How Gerrymandering Tilts the 2024 Race for the House. We're joined by one of the authors, redistricting expert Michael Lee. And Michael, welcome back to The Source.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So y'all estimate in this report that there is a 16-seat advantage for Republicans because of the way that districts are drawn up. So what does that mean? Does that give them a guarantee of a majority in the House?
No, it doesn't give them a guarantee of a majority, but it does make the House more competitive than you would think it would be in an environment where Democrats seem to be. It seems to be an environment where it's a Democratic plus two or Democratic plus three, and you would think that under those circumstances, Democrats would have a comfortable majority, but it looks like instead the House is a true toss-up. If Democrats win a majority, a lot of projections show that they win between 219 and 221 seats. So a very, very thin majority, and that's really because of gerrymandering predominantly in the South and in the states of the Midwest.
Now, what does that mean? So we know gerrymandering means using extreme sort of cockeyed ways of drawing congressional districts in order to gain an advantage. But is gerrymandering, when does something become gerrymandered? When is it bad?
So Congress in 2022 came really close to passing a bill called the Freedom to Vote Act, which would have had strong anti-gerrymandering standards. And what we did is we use those standards and used alternative maps to figure out what states would fail those standards and then what a fair map would look like. And if in Texas, for example, we find that there are probably five extra Republican seats, which I think for most Texans wouldn't actually be very surprising, because if you look at the number of seats that Democrats hold in Texas, it's not anywhere near the share of votes that Democrats have been getting in recent elections. And it's not hard to see why. If you look at maps that, for example, connect the suburbs of Dallas with the Texas Panhandle, or that break up very diverse coalition districts in and around Houston, it's not really hard to see how you sort of get that. And likewise, in Florida, there are about five extra Republican seats, in South Carolina one, Tennessee one, and you sort of build that up. And really, this is built up because Republicans had disproportionate control of the redistricting process. So they drew 191 congressional districts. Democrats drew only 75. And in most of the states where Democrats drew maps, there's states like Massachusetts, or oftentimes states like Massachusetts or Maryland, where they already control all the seats or almost all of the seats. So Democrats really couldn't do much more. Republicans in these very fast-growing and diverse states, especially in the South, really did slice and dice communities to produce results that are wildly disproportionate and not at all what you would expect in very competitive states.
Well, let's be real. Don't Democrats do gerrymandering as well?
They do. And what we found is that there are certainly maps that favored Democrats. The biggest one is in Illinois, where there are probably three extra Democratic seats, and Republicans complained very loudly about that. Democrats in Illinois, I think, were pretty open about what they were doing. But Illinois is the only big state that has a strong Democratic bias. There also were weaker Democratic gerrymanders in places like Oregon and New Mexico that tended to produce competitive districts rather than safe Democratic seats. But Republicans in places like Texas and North Carolina really drew sort of fortress maps. There's not a really a competitive district anywhere in Texas, and likewise in North Carolina, you have, you know, a true battleground state where, you know, Vice President Harris and former President Trump are neck and neck, and where, you know, every race really seems to be very tight. And yet you have a map that could elect 11 Republicans and just 3 Democrats. And that's wildly disproportionate.
So we hear the words pack and crack a lot when it comes to gerrymandering. If you're going to, if you're like Texas, you want to either pack all the Democrats into one congressional district as you can, or then crack them like Austin, you slice them up like a pizza so it doesn't really have a single representative and it gets, and their voice gets diluted. Are you seeing that in your study?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, when you look at, you know, the states that we found have bias, if you went there, you know, and talked to the people there, you know, they could easily identify what happened. So, for example, in Utah, we find that there's one extra Republican seat that's really due to the cracking or the division of Salt Lake City into among all 4 of the state's congressional districts. Likewise, in Tennessee, Republicans very blatantly dismantled a district that used to include all of Nashville and divided the Nashville region up among different congressional districts, much like happened in Austin in prior decades. And that really sort of, you know, the techniques aren't new, but, you know, they are getting more aggressive. Absolutely.
And what about technology? Is that helping gerrymandering become more effective?
It is in a lot of ways, because now you know more about voters than you used to know. And you know, this is based on all kinds of modeling. And so you know not only is a person a Democrat or a Republican, or, you know, a lean Democrat or a lean Republican, but how, you know, how likely they are to vote in midterm elections, how likely they are to vote in presidential elections. And so you can really draw maps with micro precision. Now, that said, in places like Texas and in the South, you also can rely a lot on race, because race is a pretty good proxy for partisanship in a lot of these places. And so it's very easy to sort of just use race as a crude tool. And it gets you, you know, along a lot of the way there, you know, 60, 70, 75% of the way there. But then technology helps make the gerrymanders just really stick.
But isn't gerrymandering on the basis of race illegal? Constitutional?
It can be. It's supposed to be. But, you know, what we've seen in states around the country is that people defend racially discriminatory maps on the basis of politics. We weren't discriminating against Black people. We were discriminating against Democrats. And they, lo and behold, they just happened to be Black or Latino or Asian. And so, you know, that's a loophole that the Supreme Court has left, because it said that partisan gerrymandering is something it won't police, but racial gerrymandering is supposed to be off limits. But race and politics are oftentimes joined at the hip.
So really quickly, because we're out of time here, so what did you say about Texas? How many extra seats does gerrymandering give Republicans in Texas?
About 5. You know, and what you would, you know, Democrats only hold about 13 seats right now. You would think a fair map would have about 18.
All right. Michael Lee, he is a redistricting expert. He is part of a group. They authored a new study that came out today from the Brenham Center for Justice at NYU Law. It is called How Gerrymandering Tilts the 2024 Race for the House. Michael, great to talk to you again. Hope you're doing well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, when we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about the tradition in America of exclusion and inclusion of the vote. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The election of 2020 was the highest voting eligible population turnout in presidential history since 1900. About 2/3 of eligible voters were able to cast a ballot. This election, in just about 42 days away now, is expected to surpass that. So if someone is trying to do voter suppression in America, you could say, well, they're doing a terrible job of it because people are voting. But you do have to take a deeper and a more look at the historic context. This election looks like it's going to be decided by a relatively, you know, just a few bunch of people. And so the game is afoot to make it harder for some people to vote than for others. American history can be seen as a constant tug of war over who gets to vote and who is kept from voting. And that story is told in the new book, Represent, The Unfinished Fight for the Vote. We're joined by the co-author, Mark Favreau, and he is also the other co-author, is Michael Eric Dyson. So, Mark, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me, David.
So, interesting book. This is kind of written at a YA kind of angle, is it?
That's right. It's written for young adults. It's really intended for all readers, but it's especially intended for people who are first kind of encountering this history in high school.
And we're seeing a big number of first-time voters in this presidential election. And so I'm sure many people are wondering, like, what exactly am I expected? What am I doing here to go vote?
Right. We're seeing a lot of new voters, but still nationally, the most recent statistic is that 18 to 24, less than a quarter of eligible voters voted in any election. So there's still an enormous opportunity for young people to get engaged. And there are a lot of polls showing that for a variety of reasons, young people are especially disaffected from the presidential election. So there's still a lot of work to do, a lot of education.
Yeah. And we're, you know, very curious about what young people are thinking as they go vote, as they're experiencing this election cycle. Texas Public Radio is having a young voters listening session that's going to be tomorrow here at our headquarters, at our media center at 6:30 p.m. Our doors open. It's a community discussion with college-age voters about what issues are important to them in the 2024 election. And we really hope we get a good turnout of folks and get a great sampling of, like, what is it that motivates? What are people worried about? What are they, why, what questions do they have about voting? And you've been doing a similar thing. What have you been doing in San Antonio, Mark?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I'm here to attend a really excellent event tonight at Clark High School of the Northside Independent School District from 6 to 8 p.m. It's open to the public. It's about empowering voters. So I'm being interviewed about my book, but there's a lot of other activities at the event. There's going to be items from the archives of the Willie Velasquez and the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, which is highlighted in this book, really important part of local history. And students can register to vote. They can learn about the voting process. They can learn how to be a paid election worker and more. And I've really been invited as well from a group of really tremendous local school librarians to give presentations at other local high schools. And, you know, I have to say that the librarians in San Antonio are doing the work around voter empowerment and voter education. It's really impressive and really exciting to be part of it.
So when you go to high schools and you're talking to young voters, people who are interested, what are they asking you? How aware are they of what's going on?
You know, it's interesting. They know a lot, right? So kids, I have two college-age kids myself. They're very, very plugged in with what's happening in the world. I think they know less about the long history of voter exclusion and about this kind of tug of war, as you say, over democracy. I think when they hear things like democracy is on the ballot, there's not a lot of historical sort of background knowledge to that. That is by no means limited to young people, by the way. And I think a lot of people have very hard questions. They've asked me about, but why really should I vote? Like, what difference will it make in my life? And that is also not limited to students in this area. I think many people, many college students are asking this question. As many people are engaged as are not engaged. And these are all very smart people. So there's definitely hard questions and difficult answers.
So the Constitution, 27th Amendment, last amendment that we have, lowered the voting age to 18. And I remember when that happened and what a big deal it was at the time. Because the Vietnam War was going on, there was a lot of concern. The young people really wanted to get out there and vote. And even today, though, it seems like a lot of young people aren't even aware that that amendment exists and that they fought for the vote to be able to vote at 18, and how important it was at the time. You know, are you coming in contact with that lack of awareness?
Oh, for sure. And actually, I bring up a clipping I have in my file. I have it with me, actually. It's from my dad. He's in high school, and he's 17 years old, and he's petitioning the Maine state legislature to lower the voting age to 18. and he's assuring them that he won't fall prey to communist influence. So this is 1956. But actually, I should say that we talked about it this morning. I was at Stevens High School, a really excellent audience of young people, and the room felt that the voting age should be lowered to 16, which frankly I don't disagree with. And that would energize people, that it is so that 18 takes you just beyond, in many cases, the high school years, or it's right at the cusp. So it's hard to get people interested in anything but being a senior. So they seemed really, I have to say, energized and empowered by the idea of lowering it slightly. There might be something to that.
Well, we'll see what our listeners think. Their number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What do you think about the possibility of lowering the voting age to possibly 16? What are you seeing with young people about their level of engagement in this election and overall questions about the unfinished fight for the vote? So that's the subtext title of the book. What are you focusing on in there?
So the book is actually a historical deep dive. It starts off, you know, really, we've heard a lot this year that democracy is on the ballot. I think the point we make is that it's kind of always been on the ballot. That democracy, the access to the vote, has always been uncertain. We didn't start out as a country where, you know, it was sort of formally a democracy. That sort of sounds like a controversial statement, but it's just technically true that the vast majority of people could not vote. They had to fight for their right to vote. So we argue that the American story in many ways is all of these different groups of people, women, African Americans, immigrants, people who speak Spanish, people who didn't own property, kind of fighting for inclusion in this circle of representation and really understanding not having the vote, what it means to have the vote, what kind of power comes along with representation. So part of our purpose here is that in telling that story of exclusion and of lacking kind of democratic access, it really sheds a new kind of light on the present when it seems like to a lot of people voting is not a big deal. It has no impact on their lives. I think we want to show like sort of from the people who knew what it was like not to have the vote, what it was like and just how much they gave up to get it. But we pivot then because technically, you know, as of August 8th, 1965, the Voting Rights Act, where people do have the right to vote, strictly speaking, in the U.S., to all of the new ways that voting has been suppressed and kind of generally discouraged, let's say, in the United States, which is a really strange but true fact about the world's oldest democracy, that, you know, voting is kind of looked down on. It kind of sometimes is treated as a suspect activity. And why that is. Why is it that certain types of activities are targeted? Why are certain people accused of voter fraud, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I can understand why young people would be reluctant to get into the messy business of politics. It is tawdry. It is corrupt. It is hostile, infuriating. Why would I want to be – why wouldn't I want to keep that as far away from my life as possible? Because if I'm not aware that by – not voting, I'm becoming, you know, I don't have a voice, but I have to get involved into something that is really just icky.
It's a good question. I think, though, that hasn't come up much when I've talked to kids. It's most, I say kids, these are effectively adults, right? Young adults and adults. I think when they are engaged, it's the realization that there's so much at stake for them, for their, like, I was having a great conversation with a young woman today at a high school that realizing that her own control over her own body was at stake in elections. And I think really, really feeling that. I think, you know, when it comes to questions of what we can read and what kind of books we have access to, or what our foreign policy is, where are we going to get sent away as
climate change,
you know, heat deserts, food, everything. I think younger people are much more aware, given their access to media, about really what's at stake in their own lives. And I think when that's connected to voting, and it is connected to voting, I think that's where the door opens.
Let's go to Sean on the phones. And Sean, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Yeah, so I teach at the college level, and I understand there's, you know, we're trying to get students motivated. Maybe getting 16 will get them motivated because they're kind of a trapped audience. But I just, it's very interesting, the younger generation, and it's a pattern that I see and a lot of others too, they just aren't aware of things. I love movies. I use movies a lot in my lessons. And, you know, I'll show like a clip from The Matrix and no one knows what it is. And then students will be like, well, I wasn't alive back then, so I don't know what this is. And it's like, you know, I wasn't alive in the French Revolution, but I know what that is. It's very strange where, I don't know if it's social media or if it has to do with just shorter attention spans, or maybe it's just structural in the education system, but I'm now doing politics, and they just are just so unaware of anything, a lot of them. But there's like it's not just unaware, it's like this complete disregard for anything that a lot of them show that I've never seen before.
All right, Sean, thank you for that call. I appreciate it. I think it boils down to the nature of information today. That information is so accessible that when people, the young people, if they don't know about it, then it's not important. If they need to know about it, they can look it up when they need to know it. But what do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I agree in the sense that, like, I mean, part of the reason we wrote a book, which of course is an old-fashioned technology, is that I do think that many people, and not just young people, lack that kind of broad arc information, the kind of narrative storytelling thing that maybe someone of my generation got more readily, given the kind of education we had and just given the kind of access to technology we had. However, I will say that I find that a lot of young people I talk to, when they know something, they know it at such a granular detail, because you can get interested in like this political scandal, and then you can watch the 17,000 YouTube videos about it. And maybe not all of the information is accurate. Sometimes it is. But I do feel like they have an ability to sort of like keep seeking something out. So there's a little hope embedded there. But you probably encounter a much broader pattern than I do in the classroom.
I'm still kind of stuck on not knowing what the Matrix was.
I know, right?
We'll tell them that this is John Wick trapped in a computer, right, and maybe they'll get onto that. So tell me about working with Eric Dyson.
Michael Eric Dyson is a great teacher, popularizer, intellectual. He's one of the people who work in the academy who's made a career out of breaking those kind of ideas out. He came onto my radar so many years ago because he first started treating hip-hop as a serious subject and teaching it at Georgetown. And so we got together over my interest in reaching a different kind of audience and his interest in reaching a younger audience. And our prior book was called Unequal. It was conceived in the summer of 2020, the kind of summer of the great uprising following George Floyd's murder. And we similarly provide this sort of long arc history about the Black freedom struggle beginning in the Reconstruction era and going right through to the present. That similar type of effort to like connect past and present and to show people how the two are connected and how history is kind of really just prologue, which is why we should study it.
Right, but still, like we heard from the caller, you know, getting people turned on to the history, that's telling people, you know, your grandparents fought for your right to vote, and then you get like a blank response.
Yeah, I do think that to that point, I've experimented with a lot of ways to talk about this subject, and I tend to agree with you. The less blank response is when that "they died for your right to vote" is kind of the backstory. But really, this book talks about the present and like what happens when you vote. Like, what is voting? In fact, we talk a lot about what is voting, period. You know, like, it's not just this limited kind of pulling of the lever, pushing of a button. It's a broader activity that really allows your voice to be represented in a kind of broader context. So I think that's a little bit more important for young people, is understanding the power they have.
All right, so we're going to take a break here. We're going to continue our conversation with Mark Favreau. His book is Represent, The Unfinished Fight for the Vote. And we're going to get a caller on the air. It's Javier. We'll get you on the air when we come back from this break. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What is your relationship with your vote? How do you see it? Do you see it as something to be cherished or transactional? What is it about you and the vote? Give us a call. Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio is Mark Favreau. His book is Represent, The Unfinished Fight for the Vote. He's the co-author. The other author is Michael Eric Dyson, and he has a good excuse not to be here right now. What is that?
Yeah, he's on The View today talking about the book. Yeah, oh. So somebody had to do it.
All right, yeah. So he yeah. drew the short straw.
Right, exactly, I got to come to San Antonio.
And so you get to come on, yeah. Kept in San Antonio. Yeah. And let's go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255. We are talking about your relationship with your vote. How do you see it in level of importance? Do you see it as part of your emotional connectivity with the world and the universe? Do you see it as something transactional? How do you see that vote and how you came to have it? Because most of us, would not be able to vote under the way the nation was first adopted. You had to be a white male with property. Things have changed. So what about that? Let's go to Javier on the phones. And Javier, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, Dave. Hey, I wanted to make a comment and or suggestion to Mark there. About we moved from the barrio to we live a couple of blocks from Clark High School. We're going to plan to go to that meeting tonight. But I wanted to suggest if he hasn't already, Mark, take those meetings to some of the high schools in the barrio. Talk about addressing the disenfranchised, quote unquote, people or area, it might be a good idea. I guarantee you might get a handful of people who even know who Willie Velasquez is and, was, I'm sorry, and what the importance of him and his, people were of getting the people in the barrio registered.
Right. Thank you so much for the call. And Javier, I appreciate that. So give us a plug again about where you're going tonight, Clark High School, and then, we'll talk some more.
Right. That's a great idea, by the way, Javier. And I'll look into it. But so tonight, the event is at Clark High School, Northside Independent School District, 6 to 8 p.m. So it's a voter education event, empowering voters event. I'm going to get interviewed about the book by a couple of high school students, but there's also going to be a lot of information about voter education, voting process, learning how to vote, et cetera. A really worthwhile event, 6 to 8 tonight.
And, of course, there are plenty of high schools in San Antonio, Lanier, Edgewood, South San, lots of places to go, unfortunately. It's just, we'll work on that, Javier. Thanks for that. I also want to draw attention that Texas Public Radio tomorrow night here at our headquarters in downtown San Antonio on the banks of the San Pedro Creek, we're having a young San Antonio voters listening session, a community discussion with college-age voters about what issues are important to them in this 2024 election. And that's going to be the doors open at 6:30, discussion at 7 p.m. It's part of the America Amplified Project. And we want to have as many folks show up. And we do have some validated parking, all sorts of good things with that. So please come for that event. And so talking to young people, the idea, though, is if we can get people young voting when they're young, they're going to be lifetime voters.
I think that. So the idea is to get people voting, and I think voter engagement at an early age is important. But I think more importantly, like for our democracy and for people's individual interests and community needs to be adequately represented, I think getting people as early as possible to recognize the relationship between one vote and our political process, but also our political world and outcomes is so important. Because our system, as kind of, old and fusty as it seems, and, it seems to many people quite accurately sometimes that it only serves kind of affluent communities, it only serves the money and people with influence. That is true, but it is also very, very responsive to voting.
Those are the people who vote. I mean, they drive past a local school every Tuesday just in case there's an election. They want to make sure they vote.
Exactly. And you heard from the Brennan expert earlier about all of this expertise in kind of analysis about who votes, right? All those same systems are used by political candidates, used by people in office, they're used by political parties to examine who votes at any given time. So you can vote and influence the outcome of an election, but if you don't vote, you're still influencing the outcome of election. So you're still being counted. People are still paying attention to this community, let's say, that has low voter turnout, and they understand that that community does not have to be represented. And you better believe if that community started voting en masse that that things would change. I think that's a tough lesson to get across without having experienced it. But there's so many places in the U.S. that have gotten politically active and seen things turn around. I think that's the most important thing.
Let's go to another caller. We have Robert. And Robert, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Great.
I'm just calling in to comment about lowering the voting age.
And, yeah.
I think theoretically it would be a great idea to get the students involved in you know their future life decisions. However, I would say I don't think it is. So they encourage us a lot in high school to vote and everything like that. But I think it would be more prone to getting them involved with local voting. Maybe start there, do some representative research and really find out, you know, how the students view their lives and where they want to go and things like that.
All right, Robert, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate that. And Mark Favreau.
Yeah. I don't think there's actually a proposal on the books now to lower the voting age, just to be clear. That was my discussion with the group.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, I will say that in Australia, let's take the example of a large democracy, they start educating high school students about voting rights and voting process. In the ninth grade, voting is mandatory by the time you turn 18, but there's a whole like civic engagement process that lasts 4 years. And by the time you're done, your first vote's a big, big deal. And then you're required to vote for the rest of your life. And I think there's something to that, whether we vote lower the age or whatever. There's something about sort of making this really a central turning point in your life that's really important.
Now, the caller, our number is 833-877-8255. If you want to join in, 833-TPR-TALK. Love to hear from you. Let's go to Michael on the phones. And, Michael, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing? I was just agreeing with the speaker over there about lowering the voting age. I know at the age of 16, I was working and I was paying taxes. So it'd be nice to, you know, at the age of 16, to be able to decide where some of that tax money goes, as well as, you know, a lot of these high school students having to deal with all the gun shootings and things of that nature. You can also get tried as an adult at 17. So lowering the voting age, I really don't see a problem with it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. And let's go now to this is Joe. And Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, my question is, what is the media's role in this? Because it's really hard to find the lower, you know, the national, everybody knows that. But even things like senators and city council and congressmen, you don't get any information on that. And even lower than that, like railroad commissioners, county commissioners, you don't get information from those people, what they're running for, what they stand for.
All right, Joe, you wound me, Joe. We do that every, you know, as much as we can, you know, but I hear you that it's, you know, like right now we're having the presidential election on, coming up here in November, and everybody's focused on that, and then we have the election for U.S. Senate, and maybe we're able to talk about Democrat Colin Allred trying to challenge Republican Ted Cruz. And then we have all these judges and all these state reps and congressional seats. And also we have city charter issues as well. It's really hard to explain everything that is happening on the ballot. And sometimes I walk into to go vote and I know these people. And then like, oh, look, I'm confused too. So, Mark, what about all that?
I was going to say, sometimes I walk into the booth to vote and I don't know them. And I think it's embarrassing sometimes as someone who's so interested in this history that it's it can be challenging. I think, fortunately, I was asked this question this morning at Stevens High School, and I do think, fortunately, there are a lot of really extraordinary online resources and a lot of great nonprofit sector effort going into voter education such that you can key in a district and you can get the records of everybody running, you can get their platforms. Obviously, this stuff needs to be more front and center. But for the first time, we can actually figure this stuff out. And it's part of what voting is. You know, it's like all the work that goes that wraps around it, not just that actual moment of pulling the lever.
But a lot of people think I shouldn't go vote because I really don't know everything. I don't feel prepared.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can be prepared enough. And, you know, there's the metaphor that people have been throwing a lot about around a lot about voting, which is like, if you want to get home and you want to take a public bus and the public bus doesn't go to the front door of your house, you still get on the public bus that goes close enough, right? If you know the direction that you want the country to be going in, you can still vote and tilt things in your direction. I think, again, by not voting, you're really amplifying the voices of people you may not agree with. So the more you can learn and the more you can educate yourself, even if it's just enough, I would say walk in the booth and vote for what you know about.
Right. And you can vote just for a few races that you feel confident about, and you can leave other things blank. You don't have to do the whole thing.
Right.
So that may not be a reason not to vote. You know, you can...
Right.
You can do all that. All right, we're going to take a break here. Our phones are open, and the number is 833-877-8255. And we want to hear from you about your relationship with your vote. Do you feel like it's precious and you just don't want to give it away? Or do you feel like the whole thing is corrupt? And why would you want to get involved with that? We just want to hear about what is your calculus about deciding to get off the couch and go vote, and what do you want others to take away from how you get there? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. With me in the studio, Mark Favreau. His book is Represent, The Unfinished Fight for the Vote. And we're asking you, like, what's up with your vote? What are you going to do with it? You don't tell me how you're going to vote, but are you going to use it? And how did you get there to decide that you're going to vote? Give us a call. We have Joe, also another Joe, Joe 2 on the phones. And Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to inform the previous Joe that the local Bear Democratic Party has been proactively putting forth social media information regarding candidates. We just launched a year ago, September 16th, a KDEM Bear County video platform on YouTube. And the first initiative that we conducted was an analysis of the 16 amendments that we had on the ballot this past spring so that people would be more informed of what the ballots were, I mean, what the amendments were all about and how they were going to impact lives, their own lives especially, of course, and their communities. So there is a lot of proactivity going on with one of the major parties here in Bear County, led by Monica Alcantara, our chairperson. And we're trying to make every effort possible to make voters more aware of the electeds in office, those running for re-election, those candidates that are trying to get into office. And so it's...
All right, Joe, thank you so much. Appreciate that. And they are definitely... The thing is, we live in a very stratified society, and people kind of stay on their lair, and it's hard for people to kind of bounce around and get information because of all the algorithms. It's just basically telling us everything we already know, pretty much. So what do you think about, you know, these efforts that you hear from the Bear County Democratic Party?
I think they're great. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, yeah, we live in a stratified society. There's no one watches the same news program at night anymore, of course, and all that. But a lot of these efforts are actually quite new. Even the online ones that I've been pointing out, the League of Women Voters and other really kind of national organizations. So it's a huge open field, and a lot of people are stepping into it. So I don't think it is at this moment actually is a hopeful situation on the rise with the type of efforts we just heard about, which is that more and more political parties, candidates, nonprofit organizations are getting into the work. So, but it's just all brand spanking new. So, you know, the sky's the limit, and we all need to be paying attention to it.
We have a call, a question from an on-air person, didn't want to go on air. It says, according to neuroscience, our brains aren't developed until our mid-20s. We don't need teenagers making decisions like that about our political future, you know. So any response to, like, it's too early?
Yeah, there might be something to it. It was a notional platform on my part. But I will say that, you know, I've done a lot of reading lately about adolescence and neuroscience, and it does extend from 12, 13 all the way to your late 20s. So the question of 16 versus 18 may be one that's not material anymore. Now, again, this is my proposal, and it's a very modest one at this point. But still, I think there's something to be said about what we're going to do for a younger generation and how to get them involved.
So we are definitely seeing in Texas the Attorney General here, Ken Paxton, doing things to keep people from being able to register to vote. He has sued Bexar County when they made a voter registration effort, sending out voter registration cards to folks. And there's just a long history of Texas keeping people from voting. We had the white primary system, which you had to be only white people were allowed to vote in the Democratic Party. And at the time, it was basically the only party that existed in the state of Texas. So the issue to bring forth to some people saying, if your vote didn't matter, why are they trying so hard to keep you from voting? And what do you hear from young people on that?
Yeah, well, I think the main thing that sort of needs to be said about that, and we talked about this today, and I've talked about it many times before with young people, is what they hear over the, you know, through social media, they hear about voter fraud, right? So there's a backdrop to all of these efforts, and it's called the risk of voter fraud. What they don't know, which is what the experts know, is that voter fraud is statistically insignificant. There's never been any documented case of voter fraud overturning an election. It's been widely, widely pushed in recent years. But so one thing we do in our book is to look back over history and say, like, when does voter fraud get trotted out, right? And allegations of voter fraud always precede any evidence of voter fraud. The first time documented voter fraud is trotted out is when a group of women in New Jersey who had been allowed to vote in 1800 were disenfranchised. That fraud specifically gets used. We don't want women to vote. Voter fraud is trotted out when it comes to African Americans voting in the North in the 1820s, African Americans voting in large numbers in the South during Reconstruction, immigrants in the early part of the 20th century. It's kind of always when people are seeking access to the vote, and people do not want them to have that access, that this phrase gets brought out.
So the purity of the ballot.
Right, exactly.
You know, you hear that all the time. They even hear it today. I mean, in the Texas legislature, when they talk about new laws to make it harder to vote. So,
but it's a solution that is kind of preceding any evidence of a real problem. And that, I think that's the key to understand, because all these things sound reasonable on their face, but you realize what the outcome is, which is voter suppression and actual disfranchisement of certain communities, like you see what the intention is.
Let's go to Laura on the phones. And Laura, you're on the air.
All right. Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for your book. I'm a 50-something-year-old woman, and I vote regularly. I see it as a precious gift, like a brand car. I have duties. I have obligations. I have to pay to have it registered and all of those things. But it's a precious, precious gift. And, you know, at my age, women of my age, my grandmother couldn't vote until she was in her 20s. And I would never shirk that duty. And I hope everyone does, you know, and along with it goes jury duty and all of those wonderful things that go along with the gift of voting.
Well, Laura, thank you so much. I'm so glad you called in on that. Do women typically see the 19th Amendment, you know, was a huge fight in order to get that passed and give women the right to vote and put it in the Constitution so you can't take it away without repealing that. It'd be very difficult. When you talk to young women, do they talk about, to see themselves as having been oppressed?
Well, it's interesting. I think I happened to have this conversation this morning, in fact, at a high school, which was that, you know, women are the most dynamic voting bloc. I mean, they're the people most likely to vote if you look at just the bloc on a gender basis. And they've seized that right to great effect. Women, of course, are still dramatically underrepresented in elective office, but their numbers are growing. So I think the question then becomes, what are the issues that motivate women? And understanding that they are such a dynamic voting bloc, I mean, there is something, hopefully younger women in particular who are seeing what's happening around, particularly around reproductive rights, are seeing the power of that individual vote, because that's what's going to determine the outcome.
Let's go to Tom for the last call. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. You know, I hope your guest, I'm sorry, I can't remember your name, will, as you're speaking in front of young people, will encourage them to go beyond single-issue voting. Too many times I hear younger people get angry that the person they voted for did not accomplish what they said they would. You know, I think there's education needed as far as how this system works and that it can take years to get an initiative going where it's supposed to, and the importance of voting for people that can get along and work toward a common goal rather than, you know, being a party of no or just trying to stand in the way of progress.
A great call, Tom. I think you make some great points there. So, Mark?
Yeah, I think the point the caller makes is exactly the one we're trying to get across in this book, which is that, you know, by voting, you're trying to sort of have your voice heard and to sort of shape the world as you think it should be shaped. And that's never going to be a perfect line item process, right? So, but the world will only tilt in the direction you want it to if you vote. Now, it's the same bus metaphor. It's the same other efforts we've made to explain this to young people. But I think, you know, particularly you've seen it around sort of key foreign policy issues. Young people are really disaffected with this or that candidate. But what is really is most important to get across, which is what the caller said, is that change takes time, but also change will only happen in the direction that you want it to if you engage. If you withdraw, you've sort of it's an on-off switch. You can only work in one direction. So you're either engaged or the switch is off and you don't have that power any longer.
But if you don't vote, aren't you voting for, like, well, everything's okay?
I think that's true. Yeah, I think you're voting for the status quo. So, and if you don't like the status quo, you are becoming part of the problem. There's no question.
So, but that's your right. You can say, you
absolutely.
Know. You know, I mean, yeah. It's not Australia. I don't have to eat Demi's and, you know.
And you don't have to see kangaroos on the golf course, right?
Right, so, yeah. So, and I don't have to vote.
Right.
So tell me again what you're doing tonight at Clark High School.
Clark High School. It's an Empowering Voters event, 6 to 8 p.m. Brief book discussion. Books will be there. A lot of really interesting information. Also a great exhibit about Willie Velazquez from the UTSA Special Collections. Really important part of local history. They're going to have some artifacts there. So please come out.
And I want to talk about tomorrow night here at Texas Public Radio. We're having a Young San Antonio Voters Listening Session, a community discussion with college-age voters about what issues are important to them in the 2024 election. We're having it here at the Texas Public Radio headquarters. We're on the banks of the San Antonio River, the San Pedro Creek, excuse me. The doors open at 6:30 p.m. Discussion starts at 7 p.m. And we are looking for you to show up to talk about what's important to you in San Antonio and in politics in general. What issues are motivating you? And so, Mark Favreau, congratulations on the book, Represent, the
Thank
Unfinished
you.
Fight for the Vote.
Thanks. Great to be here, David.
Great to have you on. And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.